stationary cosmology has turned from a completely unconstrained ground for theorists into a real, in part, data-driven subject. The later years of WMAP, assuming they're ever released, and data from Planck, when it flies, will really constrain, start taking big chunks out of the space of inflationary models. So I'm going to talk about how recent advances in string theory, somewhat tied to what Frederick talked about, might help us eventually build models to confront the lessons from these two different data-driven areas. Now, what Frederick talked about in the first half of his talk was the idea of flux stabilization, and I'll review that very quickly and then move on. Okay, so the standard place where a string theorist starts when they talk about quote-unquote phenomenology, maybe somewhat surprisingly, is by discussing what happens in the other six dimensions. Okay, and what happens in the other six dimensions for most string theorists is that there is some Calabi-Yau space there. Calabi-Yau in this context really just means that it solves Einstein's equations, it reduces us from 10 to 4 space-time dimensions where we might actually live. Okay, so we have some Calabi-Yau threefold M6. Now, such models are usually discussed, the choice of the space being Calabi-Yau, because in the heterotic string, they yield 4-dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetry. Since the about 1985, string theorists have assumed that we will find n equals 1 supersymmetry at the weak scale, at least most of them, and I'll proceed on that assumption for most of this talk. Okay, so this was an obvious reason to then choose these spaces in the heterotic string. In type 2 strings, it's not quite as obvious. A Calabi-Yau space yields an n equals 2 supersymmetric world because there are twice as many spinners as in the heterotic string. And n equals 2 is of absolutely no real world interest because it can't accommodate chiral fermions. But in the mid-90s, it was realized by Polchinski and others that you can quite naturally break the supersymmetry. You can have it to n equals 1 supersymmetry by doing something that's called orientifolding. And for our purposes, that just means you add some d-brains. These are the flat hyperplane-like solitons on which open strings can end in the string theory. And also orientifold planes, which arise at some fixed points of your orientifold action. Okay, and they can, in the kinds of constructions I'll talk about, be 3 or 7-dimensional. If they're 3-dimensional, that means 3 spatial dimensions. They fill our space. And if they're 7-dimensional, they're obviously wrapping 4 dimensions of the Calabi-Yau manifold. And then because of the open string sectors, various n equals 1 gauge theories arise on the world volumes of these brains. Okay. Now I should note also a useful trick for talking about such constructions. In the type 2b theory, this data, which is a Calabi-Yau n-fold, n being 3 for the most realistic case, plus a set of brains, is actually well summarized by an auxiliary mathematical object, which is a Calabi-Yau n plus 1-fold. So for the case of a Calabi-Yau 3-fold plus brains, somehow the relevant mathematical object would be a Calabi-Yau 4-fold, which is, however, elliptically fibered. That is, they're 2 tori, varying over a 3-complex-dimensional base. This construction is called F-theory. And roughly speaking, what this construction is saying is that the brains will source the string coupling. They have tension. And so they source a variation of the string dilaton. Okay? In the 2B string, it comes paired with an axion. Now, as you move around in the 3-dimensional complex base manifold, then this combination tau is varying because the brains are at specific loci in the manifold. But by S-duality symmetry, this complex field tau doesn't really constitute a completely general complex number. It lives in the upper half plane mod SL2Z. Okay? And so you can naively replace tau with a 2-torus whose complex structure lives in precisely the same space, the upper half plane mod SL2Z, and interpret such a construction as being a family of 2 tori varying over the 3 complex dimensions that constitute the string compactification manifold. So I'll often, or if I have to, I'll refer to F-theory on a Calabi-Yau 4-fold. This is all I mean. It's a 6-dimensional extra space with this varying dilaton. Now, all such constructions, as Frederick also reviewed, come at leading order with numerous moduli fields, which are just n equals 1 chiral supermultiplets, phi I, whose potential is undetermined, in some cases to all orders in perturbation theory, in other cases just at tree level. Okay? So for any value of the complex field phi, one has a good vacuum, which gives in the approximation of unbroken supersymmetry, Minkowski space. And examples would be the dilaton, which controls the string coupling, the moduli that control the size of the Calabi-Yau, the moduli that control its shape, and any moduli that allow the brains to move around in the Calabi-Yau space. Yeah. It, only in the oriental fold limit LSN. Otherwise, it, of course, it's Fano. It has positive C1. Did that answer your question? Okay. Now, there are tens of thousands of known such Calabi-Yau moduli spaces, and tens of thousands is not a very daunting number given computing technology. Okay, but as Frederick described, the numbers get more daunting. Now, moduli are a problem for making any contact with the two subjects in real physics, particle physics and inflation, that I started with. In particle theory models, we of course don't have a moduli space of supersymmetric vacua. Supersymmetry is broken at the electroweak scale or far above. Okay, and what we want is some supersymmetry breaking F term, or maybe D term, for some modulus or gauge group that drives the supersymmetry breaking. And fifth force bounds, cosmological moduli problems, and other things tell us that we really want whatever breaks supersymmetry to give the moduli a large mass if we can. By large, I mean at least a factor of 100 higher than the weak scale to be really safe. Now, for inflationary cosmology, it may not be as obvious why these moduli are a problem, but they constitute a very serious problem. And the reason is that string theory involves extra dimensions. So if you take any 10-dimensional theory, compactified on a space of some radius r, what are you doing? Well, you start in 10-dimensional, you know, maybe Einstein frame with a root g10 times the Einstein, well, times r10, because that's the Einstein action in 10 dimensions, and then you reduce it. So the reduction, well, there will be the Einstein term in 4 dimensions, plus, you know, other terms, the kinetic terms of the moduli, and there will in general be some effective potential. But I've taken a step here. When you reduced, really a factor of the volume of the extra dimensions would have been multiplying your Einstein term. So to work properly in Einstein frame, in a frame where the gravity propagator and the scalar propagators are correctly diagonalized, you need to rescale the metric, and that rescaling brings a factor of 1 over the volume squared in front of any effective potential that arises in your dimensional reduction. Okay, now it's actually important that this thing is steep, that it goes like 1 over volume squared when you vial rescale to Einstein frame. The reason that that's important is that any energy source that you can describe in your higher dimensional theory as a local classical source, okay, cannot grow faster than the volume of M as you scale the volume of M up. That's because local Lagrangians can't produce an energy source that grows as a faster power of R than R to the sixth on a 6-dimensional space. So no matter what you do in the extra dimensions, your potential will fall off at least as fast as 1 over volume as you get to large volume. Okay. And what that means is that if you have any kind of potential inflationary energy source that's well modeled by a 10-dimensional supergravity reduction, and I don't care what the energy source is, as long as it's gonna satisfy the constraints of locality, okay, that inflationary energy will not lead to inflation in 4 dimensions. In fact, it will lead to a rapid decompactification of the extra dimensions unless the Kähler moduli are stabilized at a scale high compared to the Hubble scale of inflation. And a very similar argument tells one that one must fix the dilaton, or instead of inflation, one finds rapid runoff to zero coupling. Okay? So this is a problem that we introduced into the theory. A real physicist may not have a dilaton or an extra dimensional volume, but we do, and these are problems for us. And happily, at least in the last 5 or so years, we've started to get some control, of course it could always be improved, over the problems of moduli stabilization and supersymmetry breaking, at least in some circumstances. And the toy model I'll use, but similar things could be said in many other contexts, is this KKLT construction. So we work in the type 2B string, here's our Calabi-Yau, but we're gonna start messing up the Calabi-Yau a little bit now. The 2B theory has two different kinds of strings. It has fundamental strings and D-brain strings called D-strings. And each one is stabilized by a two-form gauge field to which it couples as the lightest charged object. So these two-form gauge fields give rise to two different three-form field strengths, which I'll call H3 and F3. And if you have 6 extra dimensions, you're then free to consider fluxes of these gauge fields threading the 3-dimensional cycles in M6. So for each 3-dimensional cycle, sigma or sigma tilde, you can turn on a flux of the Ramond-Ramond or Nebo-Schwartz three-form field strength. Now, there are extra dimensions and p-forms involved here, but The results of this are completely obvious to any physicist. This results in an energy cost that will depend on the shape of the cycles being threaded. Okay, for instance, in Maxwell theory, you know that the energy in an electric field plus a magnetic field is just E squared plus B squared. The same idea now applied in 10 dimensions with the appropriate metric factors gives you a moduli-dependent energy density arising from the flux. And in the four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric effective theory that results below the Kaluza-Klein scale, that can be modeled by a superpotential. Okay, in a supersymmetric theory, instead of writing out the full Lagrangian, I can talk about a Kalor potential that controls kinetic terms and a superpotential that governs the potential energy. And the superpotential generated by these fluxes is particularly simple. It was written down by Gukov, Vafa, and Witten. And you just take the two different three-form field strengths and wedge them with a unique three-form that the Calabi-Yau provides with you, sorry, provides for you. Okay, this three-form varies as you move in the Calabi-Yau moduli space. And so this superpotential is a function of the Calabi-Yau moduli. And for generic choices of these three forms, you can argue just classically, the shape of the Calabi-Yau is stabilized. The masses of the modes are of order alpha prime over r cubed, which means for any reasonable r, if r is 5 or 10 in string units, the mass scale is way, way, way above any scale of relevance for particle physics. And the axial dilaton is, in fact, stabilized at the same scale. Okay, and the result is a class of supergravities that experts know as no-scale supergravities. And what this means is that at tree level, classically, you accomplish the stabilization with vanishing vacuum energy, okay, at leading order. Now, still, this W that I've written, okay, if you're not an expert, you may not immediately be able to tell which Calabi-Yau moduli it depends on, but it's actually true that it never depends in particular on the overall volume modulus of the Calabi-Yau. Okay, and so your effective theory is still not going to be, even if you've incorporated the standard model, a realistic theory, because your effective theory is really still one that has light scalar fields in it. Now, assuming that alpha prime over r cubed is very large, you should integrate out all of the moduli with flux-generated masses. But the minimal set of fields you'll be left with, not including the standard model, okay, is a volume modulus rho, whose Kalor potential is given by this plus alpha prime corrections that come from integrating out other modes, and whose superpotential at leading order is just a constant. And that constant, which I've called W naught, is just F minus tau H wedge omega evaluated at the minimum for the other fields. So it's some computable number, which at least naturally you guess to be of order one. Now, if that was the effective theory, at leading order, this volume modulus is exactly flat. That follows from this data, if you work through it. Alpha prime corrections could generically be expected to give it critical points, but generically you'd expect they're also completely out of control. Now, luckily there are further corrections. Witten in 96 argued that although this W at tree level only depends on the complex structure fields, non-perturbatively rho dependence can be induced. It will come from instanton effects or from gauge theory dynamics, and it will be exponentially small in the models where it exists. And the question of the existence of such effects is purely a topological question. That is, it can be answered if you have a good mathematician as your friend. So in such models, models where the mathematicians tell you that there are divisors of the appropriate topology, the expansion of your low energy effective theory will include a constant in W and then exponentially small terms that depend on rho. Now, if you just go through and solve the equations of rho minimization now, you'll find that there is a supersymmetric vacuum naively, but rho is quite small naturally in that supersymmetric vacuum. So even alpha prime corrections that are suppressed by powers of the inverse volume are not necessarily under control. But if W naught, instead of being a generic number, is small, okay, that is small compared to the Planck scale cubed. I mean, W naught is some dimension three object, okay, then in fact, self-consistently, the vacuum to this system lies at a volume that's greater than one and grows with the log of W zero. So one can, in fact, self-consistently solve this system in a regime that one trusts if small W is attainable. And then the rho mass can easily be large enough to get away from moduli vast bounds from the kinds of experiments that Adelberger described this morning. Now, that's a toy model with a small constant W zero in it. It's also true that the simplest vacua you obtain that way are supersymmetric and anti-de Sitter. And at the level of scenarios, most of which, at least I would guess statistically speaking, should be realizable in many ways, There are many ways to add supersymmetry breaking. Okay, the original suggestion was dynamics at the end of a warped throat, where the low supersymmetry breaking scale, lambda, is tied to the warping in the throat. But it's not hard to think of other ways. You can turn on F terms for the complex moduli or dilaton instead of stabilizing supersymmetrically. You have to tune to get them small, whereas here the warping provided the small scale. But again, statistics suggest you can do that. There are some new ideas that I find more aesthetic that I'm going to describe shortly that are a work in progress with Fourier and Svercek. So they might be wrong, but I find them more aesthetic, so I'll describe them. Now note that in this kind of construction, there's no way to hide the way you're getting the small value of the cosmological term. It's exactly the same way that the people who do MSSM phenomenology do it, and it matters how they do it. The way they do it is the following. In supergravity, n equals one supergravity, the form of the scalar potential is given by this thing. It's a quadratic in dW, and then supergravity adds a minus 3W squared. Okay? And the way that people, and this is real people who build models and go try to figure out what the gravitino mass is, achieve vanishing vacuum energy is that they tune the constant in W, they shift W, to cancel whatever Susy breaking D or F term you had in the theory. So let me tell you now two important things. The first important fact is that you can tune the microphysics as we understand it today to get G string much less than one and W not small enough that you get large enough volume that you can actually trust your approximations. And the reason you can do this tune is the very large number of flux vacua that Frederick described. So we certainly said this in words and gave some heuristic arguments, and Douglas's statistical program and work of Frederick and others has, I think, established this pretty clearly. But I want to point out something else, which is that the small W-naught tune that we're performing here is, in a certain sense, one that is always performed in realistic n equals one supergravity models anyway for an entirely different reason. Okay? If you have TeV scale particles, then any phenomenologist will tell you they'll get a loop mass that's higher than TeV scale if there's any F term in the theory that's above 10 to the 11 GeV. So such models never have any F or D term that is above 10 to the 11 GeV. But they also have to tune F squared minus 3W squared over M Planck squared to zero to get the gravitino mass correct for flat space, to understand what cosmology they're dealing with. And exactly that tune tells you that in their realistic models, the constant term in W, W evaluated in the vacuum, must be small. Okay, it's being played off against a term that can be no larger than 10 to the minus 8 in Planck units. So while you may or may not like the fact that we have to tune to get small W naught, if you look at supergravity review papers and try to do early universe phenomenology in supergravity, you've already swallowed this tune. And all that happens here is that in suitable models, it can help to achieve some kind of controlled moduli stabilization. Now, I quickly reviewed this KKLT construction. By now, there's a whole zoo of these things that Frederick talked about. There are many similar and many different constructions, some in the same string theory, some in other string theories. In type 2A, for instance, fluxes alone let you classically stabilize all moduli, so you don't need the instantons. Okay, I think what I'll say in 2B will be representative enough, so I'm not going to worry about trying to dualize everything and give you the picture in every possible string. So I'm going to use this 2B picture now to discuss contact with particle physics and inflation. And when I say contact with particle physics, if there's any actual particle phenomenologist in the audience, I apologize. Okay, so what's a model of particle theory for a string theorist? Well, clearly a model of particle theory is an SO10 gut, okay, because that's the most aesthetic, beautiful thing, the particle content that's beautifully into the 16 of SO10, couplings unify in minimal supersymmetry. So let's pretend, whether it's true or not, that the world is well described by an SO10 supersymmetric gut. And if you tell me instead it's described by Randall Sundrum, I would have to change all my transparencies, but I could come up with a suitable story there too. Now, this, as I said, the supersymmetric gut fits well with the hierarchy. That is, supersymmetry can stabilize the Higgs mass and with gauge coupling unification. So the question is, how do you engineer such models with Susy breaking built in and in this kind of framework that I've been describing? Can you do it? The traditional approach to Susy guts would sound somewhat orthogonal to the F-theory constructions I was describing, okay, since the work of Rzhava and Witten, or really going back 20 years to the perturbative heterotic string, the picture has been that the heterotic string leads to a Susie Gut at low energies. Okay, and for Java-Witten, the way that works is as follows. There are 7 extra dimensions. 6 of them are small, and we'll ignore them. 1 is slightly larger. It's an interval. And at the 2 ends of this extra interval, well, we sit at one end, and there's some hidden E8 gauge group sitting at the other. This was, if you want, the first brain world scenario. And, well, you then imagine the gut is here, and something happens in the hidden E8 to break supersymmetry. And if you tune the size of the fifth dimension, Witten pointed out, you can also achieve a unification of gauge and gravitational forces at the same energy scale. Now, how do you deal with supersymmetry breaking? There's a literature of several thousand papers about this subject in string theory, and the standard approach, well, for instance, summarized by Kaplanovsky and Lewis, very clear thinkers, was to just assume that there's some modulus F term. You can pick whichever modulus you want, and then derive soft Susie breaking terms that result from dimensional reduction in the presence of that modulus F term. Okay. And here what I'd like to do is first say we're now far enough along that at least in many cases we can provide some kind of microscopic underpinning that's different than just assuming some F term. And secondly, I'd like to try and actually improve the mechanism. The standard mechanism assumed in this literature in the heterotic string comes with flavor problems for a reason that I'll explain. So, again, you'll now have whiplash because I'm not going to work in the heterotic string. I'm going to work in F-theory. But it's well known that F-theory and the heterotic string are dual. Okay, F-theory on a K3 vibration over some surface B, the surface B should be four-dimensional if we want four-dimensional physics, is dual to the heterotic string on the elliptic Calabi-Yau threefold over the same base B. Now, this sounds special. There's an elliptic Calabi-Yau threefold here. Where did ellipticity enter in the heterotic string? I'll get there in a second. But Friedman, Morgan, and Witten worked out many aspects of the dictionary between these two sides, and the rough slogan, which is all you'll need for this talk, okay, forget about elliptic Calabi-Yaus, is that the E8 walls of the heterotic string turn into D7 brain stacks in the type 2B string. Okay, so they were 9 planes in M-theory, but they become D7 brain stacks in type 2B. Now, happily, and this is where the elliptic threefolds enter, it's precisely heterotic models on elliptic Calabi-Yau threefolds that have been intensely studied in the last 8 years by people like Dinaghi over at Pantev, and I think Bert will probably talk about that tomorrow. Okay. And using the so-called spectral cover construction that gives you gauge bundles on such threefolds, they can make pseudo-realistic guts. Now, the nice point for us is they've been doing all of this in elliptic Calabi-Yau threefolds. So via Friedman, Morgan, Witten, we can in fact take many, though not all, of their models and map them over with zero thought to the type 2B or F-theory constructions. But then we can run the whole story that Frederick reviewed and that I reviewed. So we're now in F-theory on a fourfold, and there's no reason we can't assume or try to check that stabilization of that model occurs by the fluxes and non-perturbative effects I described. The resulting picture being that there's a large sphere going from 10 to 8 dimensions, and then there are 2 7 brain stacks, one dual to our E8, one dual to the hidden E8, and the gut lives on one of these D7 stacks, and at the other end of this P1, the sphere, is the hidden E8. In such a scenario, all closed string moduli are fixed at a high scale. Why don't we do this directly in the heterotic string? Well, as Frederick described, once you turn on the fluxes in type 2B, okay, dualizing back to the heterotic string, which you could still in principle do, produces what could be generously called a non-Kähler mess. We have no way of controlling it. But the nice thing is that in this duality frame, in the F-theory duality frame, these are precisely the effects that we've been studying. So how do you do Susie breaking? Well, there's a very easy solution, and then there's a harder solution, but that I think is better, that I'll describe later. The easy solution is, of course, to have Susie breaking in the hidden E8. There's an old slogan that you use Gugino condensates in the hidden E8. That doesn't actually work so well for reasons I'm happy to talk with anyone about later, but you can do something quite similar, which is put a dynamical Susie breaking gauge theory in the hidden E8. Okay, and it's actually not hard to explicitly make models using this spectral cover construction that can do the job. The simplest possible examples, not the best for phenomenology, are to arrange for this hidden stack of 7 brains to have a gauge theory that's either SO10 with a single chiral 16 or SU5 with a single chiral 5 bar plus 10 charged under the gauge group. Now, why do you want those contents? And then, of course, there's an observable gut, too, that's irrelevant for this part. Now, why do I want to arrange for those SO10 or SU5 contents? Well, those theories are the simplest examples that are known to break supersymmetry non-perturbatively at their dynamical scale lambda by an old argument due to Affleck, Dine, and Seiberg that's really slick. It's a really elegant argument. The argument goes as follows. These theories have no flat directions at tree level. You can't Higgs the gauge group at all. It follows from the D-term constraints. These theories have global and R symmetries. And Tupt anomaly matching, which must match between the ultraviolet weakly coupled description and the infrared Goldstone description, okay, tells you that there are actually no plausible spectra for confining pion Lagrangians in these theories. The possible spectra that match Tupt anomalies are ridiculous. They involve far too many, if you want, light composites. So the global symmetries must be spontaneously broken by the dynamics. But this means that there have to be Goldstone bosons. Now, if supersymmetry is unbroken, a Goldstone boson isn't its own supermultiplet. It has a scalar partner that complexifies it. So you have to complexify the Goldstones. But the gauge theories were designed to have no flat directions. So it's not plausible that you have complexified Goldstone multiplets. So you must have supersymmetry breaking at lambda h instead. Now, this argument is all words. Even if they're words due to Seiberg, you may be uncomfortable with an argument that's all words. So I can tell you, although I like the word argument a lot, that much more direct arguments evolved in the mid-90s due to Hitoshi Murayama, Poppets, Trivedi, and others that provide very strong support for that picture that I gave you in words. So the hidden sector breaks supersymmetry at some exponentially small scale lambda h, and the exponentially small scale is automatic. It comes about by dimensional transmutation in the normal way. Now, in string theory, normally you would now face the problem that the scale lambda is field dependent because gauge couplings are controlled by the dilaton. But the moduli were fixed at a high scale in these F-theory compactifications by tree-level flux compared to, for instance, lambda h squared over m Planck. And so there's absolutely no runaway problem, but the dynamical nature of the gauge couplings does not cause any issues. Now, in such a model, the tune that we've discussed before, the KKLT small W-naught tune, can, and I'm not saying that this is something that would always work naturally, but I'm saying in suitable models, you could relate this tune to the same tune that you'd need to do to get F squared to be of order lambda h to the fourth. That is, the small W-naught is tied to the exponentially small scale by the cosmological constant. Now, there's a problem with that model and with its predecessors in the heterotic string literature, which is that in this picture, which is a little different from the heterotic one, there's a sphere and there's a gut over here and there's Susie breaking over there, the sphere must be big in order to have control. It must be larger than the string scale in size. And for a gut model, the string scale is 10 to the 17 GeV, which means that the leading Susie breaking is communicated to us by what's often called gravity mediation. The leading force is gonna be in words, gravity talking between the two walls. No gauge charge states under both D7 groups are light enough to matter. This name is actually highly misleading, and that's the problem. What it has always meant, at least in the string theory literature, is that you communicate Susie breaking via dimension six operators in the Kähler potential. So if the F term is for some field X that's of order lambda H squared in this hidden sector, and if the QI are the quark and squirk superfields in the standard model, then the terms responsible for Susie breaking soft terms come from integrals d4 theta, that is in the Kähler potential, suppressed by two powers of m Planck that look like some constant I times QI dagger QI times X dagger X, where I is the flavor index. So the mass of the ith squark goes like some order one number CI times lambda h to the fourth over m Planck squared. And all the trouble lies in the order one constants, CI. Okay, so for a string theorist, this is a successful model of Susie breaking with soft terms. And for any phenomenologist, this is a disaster because the CI are distinct order one numbers. And so there's no squark degeneracy. And so you're killed by flavor changing neutral currents. Now, I described that the way string theorists found it. But the problem's essence and existence was emphasized by Hall, Kostolecki, and Rabi as early as 1986. Their point was that gravity mediation, by definition, is sensitive to Planck scale physics. It runs up to the Planck scale in its loops. And whatever physics determines the flavor, the difference between top quarks and up quarks in the extra dimensions, If you run all the way up to the Planck scale, you sure are going to see that, unless the manifold is sub-Planckian in size, which makes no sense. And so gravity mediation can always see the distinction between different flavors, unless you have some miraculous cancellation. And there's an obvious fix in the phenomenology literature, which is called gauge mediation, which was kind of rejuvenated by Dine, Nelson, and their collaborators in the mid-90s. And the idea here is instead of using gravity to communicate Susie breaking, you use what are called messenger fields. These are gauge charged fields whose mass is much less than the gut scale, which are charged under the standard model, and which are charged under whatever hidden sector breaks supersymmetry. And then you transmit the Susie breaking splittings to the MSSM by gauge interactions, not gravitational interactions. Now, you can't use the two E8 walls or their duals in F-theory to realize such a picture, because to have any control, the Horjava-Witten 11th dimension must be very large, or the P1 must be very large, and so you'll never have messenger states. There will never be strings that stretch between the two stacks of brains that are light enough. Yeah. Sorry? No. So if you're on a suitable elliptic Calabi-Yau, the Sen limit will give SO8 gauge groups. But in fact, quite generally, any E8 bundles, or at least any SUN bundles, where SUN is a suitably small subgroup of E8, can be mapped over to F-theory. All that will happen is that the base is Fano instead of Calabi-Yau. Okay? You're far away from the orientable limit. Right. So the picture here is, you have some gut brains, you have some hidden E8 brains, and they're good for nothing. If you use them to break Susie, the soft terms that result aren't good. So you need another point in this P1, and you need some D brains at the singularity, which break supersymmetry dynamically. Now again, luckily this is something that string theorists have worked on anyway, though without particular motivation from this problem. In fact, examples of brain models which dynamically break supersymmetry and sit at certain singularities in F-theory compactification have been developed recently by Berenstein et al. And by Hanani et al. Okay. And then the D7, D3 strings between the gut brains and whatever brains break Susie have exactly the right properties to be the standard messenger sector assumed in gauge mediation. So such models should lead to gauge mediation in string theory without the flavor problems of hidden E8 breaking that's been typical. And the heterotic dual, you even know. The heterotic dual is an E8 wall, some stack of five brains with Susie breaking. And the whole reason that it's easier to use the F-theory picture, other than moduli stabilization, is that understanding the physics of these D brains is a hell of a lot easier than understanding M5, M9 membranes, which we really don't know anything about. Okay, so now I'm going to quickly switch subjects. I've talked about particle physics. That's obviously with a very broad brush. I'm now going to talk about inflation with the same kind of broad brush, but we know less, so maybe it will pass. Let me work in the same context. We have some kind of stabilized compactification, and I want to inflate. What do I do? Well, the simplest idea, once you've stabilized the manifold, is just to add some module that inflates, and the most obvious module post-1995 is a stack of brains. So the idea of brain inflation, suggested by Zavalli and Tai and developed by Burgess and others, okay, is that you have your Calabi-Yau, and then you add maybe a brain-anti-brain pair that will annihilate when you finally reach the late-time vacuum, but whose dynamics may lead to inflation in the interim, in the early universe. Now, how plausible is it that such a pair leads to inflation? Well, they attract via Coulomb and gravitational interactions, via Coulomb because they have opposite charges, and gravity, of course, is universal. And in such a picture, inflation will end when they annihilate. Now, in string theory, the way they annihilate is that an open string tachyon is the lightest mode that stretches between them when they're less than a string length apart. And so inflation ends by tachyon condensation. In terms of a canonically normalized brain separation field phi that measures this distance, you can compute the potential in a leading approximation. It's just the brain tensions minus some interaction energy that falls off as 1/5. And this is exactly like Coulomb, except for three-dimensional particles in a 10-dimensional spacetime. Now, there are well-known issues with this scenario. The inflationary slow roll parameters that must be small for inflation to occur are this parameter epsilon and this parameter eta that roughly measure that the potential should be flat enough to be fooling the universe into a de Sitter expansion, and that the expansion should last a long enough time to get 60 e-foldings. Now, in terms of the intergrain distance r, which is related to that field phi I mentioned just by powers of attention, the Calabi-Yau radius and the Calabi-Yau radius r, okay, so the intergrain distance is little r, the Calabi-Yau radius is big r, you can just go through and compute eta, and you'll find that it's some order one number times big R over little r to the sixth power. So this looks like it produces a nice model of inflation in the regime where little r is much bigger than big R, but at least assuming an isotropic space, you surely can't separate by a little r much bigger than big R on a compact space of size r. You go around the space. Now, anisotropy a priori could help with this problem. Okay, the way I've described it seems clear, anisotropy could help, but it turns out not to, at least in simple cases, and there are arguments to that effect that are reasonably rigorous. Yeah. I don't disagree, but the formulas that give problems to the anisotropic case, I think prove under reasonable assumptions that if there's no warping in the metric, there's always an eigenvalue of eta which is less than minus a third. It might be minus a sixth. So that means that you can at most get three or six e-foldings before something goes wrong. So I can describe those arguments to you later if you want. Now, the scale of B is also a problem if you're too naive in such models. That is, if you simply take R and GS to be order one with a string scale that's gut scale times 10, 10 to the 17 GeV, and a G string that's, you know, some reasonable value that would match to alpha of 1/25 at the gut scale, okay, you'll find that the scale of inflation is getting uncomfortably close to being above the gut scale where the model would be ruled out. Now, naively, both of these issues can be resolved by complicating the geometry even more by adding warping all around Randall and Sundrum, though used for a different purpose. So now the picture, you see we're really doing terrible things to this Calabi-Yau. Here it is, and really there are all these fluxes and brains on it. And now we're including a warp factor in the metric that warps the way that Minkowski and the Calabi-Yau metric have been multiplied together. So as you move in the Calabi-Yau with coordinates y, there's an e to the 2a of y that multiplies your Minkowski scale factor. So you can imagine, and in fact can construct solutions where this warping becomes extremely small in some region of the Calabi-Yau, leading to a large redshifting of scales. Okay, then the mass of some D3 bar that was there would be warped down. The attraction between the 3 bar and the D3 brain would be smaller because the attraction is a mass squared effect. Okay, and so you would get slower roll. Now, the scale of V would also be reduced because the tension is reduced by the warping. So you can keep vanilla scales out in the bulk of the Calabi-Yau. You could put a gut model up here with no warping at all and have inflation occur down some throat elsewhere. Now, as I mentioned, it is known that Calabi-Yau models with flux can easily lead to such warped throats. Following work of Klebanov and Strasser, it's easy to construct such solutions. And by now, this particular avenue for trying to make such models has been pretty well studied as a candidate for inflation. It's maybe the most studied candidate right now in string theory, and it has problems. Okay, the first problem is that the eta problem, which you might have thought I got around by introducing the warping to make the attraction sufficiently small, does generically reappear. It reappears for subtle reasons having to do with mixings between different chiral fields, but it's really the same old supergravity eta problem that you may have heard about in previous talks. Okay, and so you need at least a 1/n of E tuning of the potential. It's not awful, but it means you have to tune something one part in 100. It's not great. And there have recently been a spate of papers on whether you can reheat the standard model in a scenario where inflation ends in a warped throat. Most of these have the standard model and some other warped throat, but I think the same basic ideas would apply to the case I'm discussing here, where the standard model lives in an unwarped region. The authors, many of them, or many of the groups that are relevant are represented, Kaufman et al., Burgess et al., Hsu et al., Frey et al. The most serious issue found is the one that Frederick mentioned, but that's also the one that's easiest to get out of. The issue that was discussed there is that these throats, in the simplest cases, have isometries, and Kaluza-Klein modes charged under the isometry can be overproduced and close the universe. But of course, one expects the generic throat has no isometries. So that you can easily escape from, but there are more detailed problems that these groups have discussed. Now, should a model like this be realizable and consistent, there are striking signatures, or at least there are possibly striking signatures. They may also arise in other brainy models. The first is the existence of cosmic superstrings, first suggested by Tai and really brought home by Copeland, Myers, Polchinski, Dvalli, and others. This is the idea that since DD bar annihilation proceeds via condensation of a tachyon, the topology of the tachyon field space can lead to the production of defects. So here's the 3-3 bar pair. There's a tachyon that arises from the lightest stretched string between these guys when they're separated by less than a string length. And its potential, in some naive sense, is a Mexican hat. It's just norm of t squared minus v squared, the quantity squared, which has pi 1 of the vacuum manifold equal to z. You can wind around the vacuum manifold. Now, this means that just by the standard Kibble mechanism, the field doesn't know to roll down the Mexican hat in the same direction at all points when it's ending inflation, you expect cosmic string production. And actually, there's been some discussion in work by Klein et al. Of maybe the fact that the correlation length is closer to string scale than Hubble scale could mean that you even overproduce various defects. Now, if you do produce these strings, they are really fundamental objects of string theory. They're type 2B D strings, or more generally, bound states of D strings and fundamental type 2B strings. Now, such strings, although you would maybe naively think they would lead to overclosure of the universe, are actually generally believed, for complicated reasons that I don't fully understand, to enter a scaling solution where the fraction of energy density in the string network over the fraction in the dominant component in the universe, which could be matter or radiation, goes like a constant. Okay, so they in fact quickly come down to be some finite fraction of the energy density and don't overclose the universe. The ratio here is actually fixed by the one invariant number you can imagine in such a scenario, which is the string tension divided by M Planck squared, often called G mu. And data actually bounds G mu to be less than about 10 to the minus 7. Now, in these models that I was describing, where, for instance, there's warping or some other way of lowering the scale of inflation, which was introduced for other reasons, the natural value of G mu, far from being close to the Planck scale, is actually between about 10 to the minus 12 and 10 to the minus 7. So they would actually fall at the upper range, right within the dangerous region for WMAP or other data to rule them out, and at the lower range, outside of that regime. Yeah, Robert. It would come from taking the potential I wrote before. There is. It would come from taking the potential I wrote before with the tensions times product of brain separations to inverse powers and warping that down sufficiently. So if you want, the G mu is small for the same reason that the scale of inflation is warped down at the end of that throat. There's just a certain number of factors of e to the a in the string tension. And when you fix the e to the a to make the inflationary model give the right delta rho over rho, it produces this value of G mu. Does that answer your question? It was a little vague. Okay. Now, the stability of these strings, even if they're produced, is highly model dependent. They may break. But at any rate, if they're there, strings in this G mu range are going to be visible by either lensing at the upper range, and I think there's even a candidate, or by gravity waves due to arguments of Damora and Vilenkin. So we might get lucky. They might be there, they might be stable, and we might see them. Even Discover magazine says so. Now, in the most optimistic scenario, you would get a lot more than just a single kind of string and a single number, G mu. You would actually get a network of different kinds of PQ strings that can end on each other, and that would be a pretty striking signature. I mean, you can mock it up in field theory, but the models in field theory are even more contrived than the models in string theory. Now, a second place where there's room for really spectacular signatures is the non-Gaussianity of the CMB fluctuations. Now, normally, to get measurable non-Gaussian signatures in inflationary models, you need to do one of two things. You either need fluctuations that don't arise from inflation, and reasonable ideas are the curvaton or modulated reheating, again, due to some people here, or you need higher derivative terms to really matter during inflation. The simplest model of that is just a model where you add a d phi to the fourth term and vary its UV suppression scale that was discussed by Cremonelli, and more complicated versions of this arise in ghost inflation and other such models. Okay, but it's been difficult to see how conventional models of this second type can be natural. in the sense that you need higher derivative terms to matter. So if you're perturbing around slow roll, well, it's hard to keep slow roll, and how do you explain the small scale that has to suppress the higher derivative term, and so forth. In other words, what gives you control over the Planck suppressed operators? Now, there is a recent idea about this, again in the context of string theory, which is why I'm discussing it, due to Silverstein and Tong, which is to use the DBI action. So for D-brains in string theory, we actually know an infinite set of higher derivative terms. And they arise in the following way. If you take the action on a D-brain, it looks like the brain tension times the square root of 1 minus gradients of the brain position field squared. Okay, where phi is one of the scalars describing the position of the brain in the extra dimensions. And then you take this whole thing to the 1/2 power. This may look bizarre, but what you should think of is the Lorentz invariant particle action, root 1 minus x dot squared. That same action generalized to brains leads to this kind of structure. Okay? So in a regime where accelerations are small, but where d phi can be appreciable, there's a reliable expansion from dBi that gives an infinite calculable number of higher derivative terms. Now, based on this L and expanding dBi in an appropriate background, which would lead to warp factors here, okay? Silverstein and collaborators actually found some class of non-slow roll models of inflation where accelerations are small, but these derivative terms matter. And these models lead, I mean, as a slogan to FNL much greater than one. I'm sure Cremonelli, if he's here, is looking grouchy because this is a very poor way of describing non-Gaussianity, but the basic point is the higher derivative terms matter, and you generate a large signature in the three-point function. Okay, and really, the three-point function has much more data. This was discussed by Babich et al. And you can compute the whole three-point function that would arise in such a model. So at least some stringy models make striking predictions for what Planck might see. And this is notable because no slow roll inflation model predicts a measurable non-Gaussianity. This was computed by Maldacena and by Ryoto et al. But I think it was obvious to many people for a long time that slow roll will not produce measurable non-Gaussianity. So if you see something there, you've learned a lot, you'll throw out almost all the inflation models that have been proposed, or at least all models of how fluctuations were generated. And in general, given the richness of what you might see, if it's measurable, which is a big if, I think more effort should actually be expended on filling out the space of models that could fill out the space of three-point functions. Now, I'm close to the end of my time. There's one other issue I wanted to discuss, and it doesn't fit in to the class of brain inflation models, but it is a question about inflation and about quantum gravity. And this is the question of whether gravity waves from inflation will be seen. Okay, there's a well-known argument due to David Lith that says that if you take R to be the tensor to scalar ratio, the ratio of the power in tensor modes to scalar modes, appropriately normalized, if it's greater than about a 1/14, then you've learned something very interesting about your model of inflation. He says that such models are always characterized by super Planckian distances in field space. That is, the inflaton rolled over greater than a Planck distance in field space during our 60E pulse. Now, what's so interesting about this is that this is not obviously possible in any quantum theory of gravity. Okay, to give you an idea of why an effective field theorist shudders when they hear this, the canonical example of inflation that does this, which may look pretty simple, is to take 1/2 m squared phi squared, set m to 10 to the 13 GeV, and let phi roll over 15 Planck lengths, and that will give 60 E-folds and a nice spectrum that's still not ruled out by data. But how on earth did you forbid all the terms that look like Cn, phi to the n plus 4 over m Planck to the n, with order 1 coefficient Cn, that you would expect most UV completions to generate? Okay, you need to do this in order to trust this simple action over 15 Planck lengths in field space. And, well, most people would say, how the hell are you going to do that? Now, there's a good idea. Some form of it was first proposed by Fries et al., which is to use a Goldstone boson that has a shift symmetry and only a single symmetry breaking parameter that controls the breaking of the symmetry, okay? So, for instance, you can use an axion. And certainly, if the axion decay constant, Fa, were greater than 15 m Planck, you could roll over order 15 distances in Planck units in axion field space without worrying about it. Yeah.
Should keep it.
Thank you. About this
higher order terms. So Lindes, Andrei Lindes' argument for this is that this is not the right expansion to make, that in fact you should expand in terms of, say, the potential divided by the Planck mass to the fourth, and so on, that as long as the energies are far below the Planck scale.
I'm not saying, yeah, good.
So what's your response to that argument?
Of course, Andrei is a colleague, and I've talked to him a lot about this. What he's arguing there, which I believe, is that if you had such a potential, 1 half m squared phi squared, the place at which it would break down, where you could no longer trust your effective theory, if you knew this was the potential, would be at a value of phi such that the energy density was Planckian, where quantum gravity becomes important. I believe if that were true, the model would just be ill-defined. Okay? But here it is true that at 15 m Planck with the right m, the energy is very sub-Planckian. But what's not true is that the calculation that eta and epsilon are much less than 1 is independent of these higher order terms. So if high energy physics that you don't know about could induce these higher order terms, you must have a good argument that it doesn't occur. Okay, and you can do that. I'm not saying that you can't, but you should be able to argue that for some reason. Yeah. Oh yeah, m squared phi squared will not generate higher potential terms from field loops. But the question is, how plausible is it that ultraviolet physics that you don't know at some higher scale, m Planck or lower, doesn't generate those? And you need an argument then. Yeah, but most of us would argue that since m Planck squared enters in the numerator of slow roll conditions, if you don't have a UV completion, you're not talking about a model. Okay. Good. So this idea of natural inflation was really to use pseudo-Goldstone bosons with the axion as the canonical example. There's a problem with using that at least to achieve chaotic inflation or this kind of super-Planckian inflation, though it may be viable for other things. And that problem is that you then have to prove that you can achieve f greater than m Planck for any of the single axion partners of the Kähler or Dilaton modes in string theory. And Banks, Dine, Fox, and Gorbatov at some level of rigor have argued that this is impossible, though their level of rigor involves some factors of 1 over 16 pi squared that were undetermined and are large compared to 15. But anyway, we thought about this problem a little bit, and we decided that if you combine this wonderful idea of natural inflation with the idea of assisted inflation that Little and others have suggested, the idea that there could be more than a single inflaton, and the vacuum energy of each field adds to the Hubble friction of all fields, so that it's easier to achieve slow roll. If you combine these two ideas, it seems that you can obtain models of super-Planckian inflation with observable R in string theory. Okay, that is, at least there's a very plausible set of ways to do this. It's not obviously impossible. Through collective motion of many axions that arise in these Calabi-Yau models. Okay, and we gave some arguments that this seems reasonable. Now, this is clearly an ugly model. Why did we talk about this? Well, it's not because I think that model is really right, but here are the ingredients that went into it. Okay, to argue that such models can exist, you have to argue that, first of all, you can have a large number of fields with independent shift symmetries. But that's true in string theory, where you get one axion for each Kähler modulus. Okay, then you had to argue that epsilon and eta die like 1 over n. And you can do that because the potential at leading order for these axions takes the form of a sum. That's sufficient to prove that these things die at least as fast as 1 over n. Now, in string theory, these axions descend from gauge symmetries at short distance. They, if you want, come from the stringy Bnu-Nu field, which has a gauge shift symmetry. So there's no large symmetry breaking by whatever, small black holes, that gives you power law corrections to the potential for these axions. Okay, the entire potential is of this Vafa-Witten form, determined by indirect arguments. Now, you also have to worry that in any model of assisted inflation, there could be n-dependent species corrections. But in this kind of UV-completed context, those are computable, and they seem sufficiently small to allow working models. But at any rate, my point here isn't to talk about this model in particular. It's to say any model with observable R seems hard to get. And if we observe, you know, gravity waves sometime in the near future with R somewhere close to a 14th, I think this would really vastly narrow our ideas for UV-completable models. It would eliminate the number down to order 1. Yeah, so I'm talking obviously here about primordial gravity waves from inflation, and if they can be disentangled in measurements is not something that I'm the right person to talk about. But maybe somebody else knows. So let me conclude. I've gone over time probably, or at least I'm right on the edge. Okay, Jamba says no. There are recent advances that strongly suggest the existence of what many people call a landscape of string vacua. But I should say that the developments that led to this name, the realization that there are many, many stabilized vacua, arose precisely because people are looking for ways to make promising avenues of constructing guts with detailed Susie-breaking dynamics, not a black box, and acceptable inflationary models. And of course, there's a lot of room for improvement, both our technical and much more importantly, though I didn't talk about it here, our conceptual understanding of what the hell is going on in this landscape. There are questions of eternal inflation. Do we have to talk about anthropics? Are there vacuum selection principles? And if so, can they ever be known in some reasonable way? These questions are deep, and I'm pretty sure they'll lead to real advances in quantum gravity when we learn to address them. But in the meantime, we have two wonderful sets of experiments coming up, and we can at least use these advances to try and make contact with those. Thank you.
Time for.
Could you repeat why this reheating problem of Lee and Kaufman was easily resolved?
Yeah, so the main problem that they discussed is the Klebanov-Strassler throat, which is used for convenience in almost all these explicit warped models, since it's the easiest example of a warped throat. The Einstein manifold above it is T11. T11 has isometries. These isometries give rise to conserved quantum numbers that are carried by Kaluza-Klein modes. And if you produce a Kaluza-Klein mode with these conserved quantum numbers, by definition, it cannot decay down to a bulk graviton or a brain state. So their problem was they would produce these, and then there would be a quantum number reason, a symmetry reason, why they couldn't decay. And my only point was, however hard it is for me or you to write down an explicit Einstein manifold that doesn't have these isometries, it's pretty clear from facts about Calabi-Yau's that lack of isometries is generic, since there's a theorem. And then the question is, how much is the isometry broken by? And my claim would actually be that